We're talking about youth gardening here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Educators and people passionate about gardening are in Wisconsin this week. The National Children and Youth Garden Symposium is underway in Madison. And the talks focus on how to help kids develop a green thumb. Share your community garden experiences. What are you growing at home? What's in your plot? What did you plant in your school garden? And parents and teachers, if the children in your life garden, what do you want them to learn? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. Beth Tuttle is CEO of the American Horticultural Society, which is based in Alexandria, Virginia. Beth, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me.
So we live in this age where we're not always connected to nature. We have our smartphones with us, our digital devices everywhere. What is the value of providing children with an outdoor education?
Well, the AHS, the American Horticultural Society, is committed to forging this vital connection between people and plants. And the reason we have such a strong focus on youth gardening is because young people are really the stewards for the environment and for plants in the next generation. Youth gardening is one of those practices that offers just a myriad of benefits that can impact health and nutrition, social and emotional development, their sense of environmental stewardship, and honestly, their academic achievement. And so we look at youth gardening as a gateway and a vital intersection where all of those aspects of the whole child come together.
And some of those youth gardens have come together in the school, in the schoolyard, mm-hmm. and schools building these plots. What do school gardens look like today?
So school gardens take all kinds of forms, and they're very much reflective of the communities that they're trying to serve. And so across the nation, they may take the form of a formal garden that is hosted on the school property that is being used as a regular part of either science, health, language arts, a range of topics may be being, and educational standards may be being addressed in that garden. In others, they may be a volunteer program that's just the school garden club, for example. So they really differ. We are seeing a great growth in habitat gardening for pollinators and to create safe spaces for migratory birds and pollinator bees. We also, of course, see lots of vegetable gardens, but we also see gardens that are designed to address, for example, the cultural diversity of areas that may have very large immigrant populations in their student bodies, and they're a form of cultural expression.
So what happens to the food cultivated in those vegetable gardens?
Well, again, it depends on the school and how it's situated and what its structure is, but there is certainly a very, very strong farm-to-school movement and a very strong movement to integrate the food that children grow onto the tables in the schools so that the children are eating what they grow. In other cases, there are strong relationships that are forged with community food banks so that food that is being grown is going to serve those who have limited or no access to fresh fruits and vegetables.
We're talking with Beth Tuttle. She is president and CEO of the American Horticultural Society. What should people know to garden about the work? And educators, do you have a garden education program at your school? What goals do you have? What does your curriculum look like? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Beth, what kind of science skills do young people develop with exposure to gardening?
Well, they're learning all kinds of skills. Math. So I want to build a 4x4 raised bed. How many cubic feet of dirt do I need? Perfect way to teach a math lesson. They're learning history. Where did this food come from? When was it introduced? Whose culture is it reflective of? And what does it mean in that culture? They're learning a lot about health and nutrition. So those kinds of skills we do have. I mean, we hear regularly last night at dinner, you know, a story of a school garden educator with a student coming up to her with an orange in her hand and saying, "What is this?" And the teacher said, "Well, it's an orange." And she said, "But oranges don't look like this." And the teacher said, "Well, what does an orange look like?" And she said, "Well, it looks like a little smiley thing. She'd only seen oranges cut up." And she said, where is this? And the teacher said, that's inside the orange. Let's cut it up.
Oh, so making that real connection to just what an orange looks like.
Very fundamental connections to your food. Where does it come from? What does it look like?
During the summer months, when we see those school gardens, who keeps them up? How do you keep up gardens? There's a lot of work that goes into gardens. It's not just about the harvest.
That's very, very true. It's actually the reason for the theme of this year's National Children and Youth Garden Symposium, which was building blocks for sustainability. Now, we're all hearing about sustainability in a context of environmental sustainability. This conference is really looking at sustainability across a number of dimensions. And the real three critical ones, of course, environmental sustainability, financial sustainability is another big challenge, and the last one is really the human capital, the sustainability of that, because gardens take work, and they take people who put hands in the dirt. So in many places, you will have a school garden that really runs for a nine-month season. Now, if you talk to somebody who gardens in Florida, you can garden year-round. There are no issues, you know, that you might have here in Wisconsin where your garden season is very short from the beginning of September till maybe the end of October. Okay. And then again, you might have a very short one in the spring. And so the opportunity that exists in those months where you cannot be outdoor gardening is to be indoors. So you could be teaching students lesson plans around how could we extend the growing season in a place where it's cold, where you might not be able to grow the same things that someone else might be able to grow. How do we propagate plants so that they are ready to go and they can get grown large enough in a short season? How do you deal with that indoors? There's all sorts of ways that people deal with that. The human piece, though, is it requires a lot of volunteer help, typically. You really need an engaged teacher, and it's critical that there be support from other parts of the community and from the administration.
And perhaps the parents
and the parents
as well.
Of course. That's what I meant when I was talking about volunteer, because in many places, the parents are also big helpers in the garden.
Yeah. And of course, then finding that plot of land as well. I mean, sometimes you've got just paved over playgrounds and you have to really figure out where that plot is.
And many of the garden educators are extremely intrepid people who will find a plot, you know, a trailer that was put up for temporary school housing, maybe coming down at the end of some need, and that leaves an open spot of terribly depressed, you know, dirt. But if you have an intrepid teacher who spots that open piece of ground, they'll often go to the administration and say, hey, is there a way that we could? And that's how they start.
So really thinking outside the box when you want to start these projects, because you're saying it's not just about the garden, it's about the curriculum.
It's about the curriculum. Lots of resources available for teachers who are interested in starting school gardens or who are interested in the vast amount of collective wisdom that this community of garden educators have. So some of those kinds of resources, there is a website called kidsgardening.org that offers just an array of well-honed curricular resources. Seed Your Future is another one of our partners. It is a movement to help young people in middle school and high school and beyond really see the value of plants, find an interest in the study of horticulture, and ultimately to pursue jobs in horticulture. Because there are lots of jobs in horticulture that are going unfilled today.
We're talking about garden education with Beth Tuttle as our guide. She's CEO of the American Horticultural Society, which is holding a national symposium this week in Madison. Teachers and daycare providers, are you hoping to start a garden for the young people you care for? What do you want them to learn? What do you need to make happen? Is it administrative support? Is it funding, access to the land? If you don't have access to a plot, how do you help your students understand and value green space? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network.
First thing you're going to work on is pulling the weeds out.
Yeah, pulling the weeds out.
My name is Anijah Howard. I'm 12 years old. The first thing that we actually come for is the strawberries, like especially when they're little because they're not nice and sweet.
We are listening to young people talking about their work at the garden at the Mary Ryan Boys and Girls Club of Greater Milwaukee in Sherman Park. It's part of the Young Farmers Program, which is run through Groundwork Milwaukee, aiming to involve young people in the food system. Talking about the value of youth gardening here on The Morning Show, I'm Kate Archer Kent. Educators and gardeners from around the country are in Madison this week for a youth gardening symposium. I want to hear from young gardeners. How is your garden doing? Have you been checking in on your school garden? Are you in a summer program where you're spending time learning how things grow? Join in at 800-642-1234. Beth Tuttle heads up the American Horticultural Society, and she stays with us. Beth, you were just talking a little bit there about plant blindness, which is actually something that is a real thing. What is plant blindness?
Well, it is a thing. You know, about, I'd say 100 years ago, maybe 2 out of every 10 people on the planet lived in an urban area. And right now we're here in Wisconsin, which has a lot of rural and agricultural area. By 1990, about 4 in 10 people lived in an urban area. Today, more than half the world's population lives in an urban area. And by the time a child entering primary school turns 40, 70% of the population is going to dwell in urban areas. And if you look at studies, the average U.S. citizen can easily recognize more than 1,000 brands and logos, but can typically name fewer than 10 local plants. So plant blindness is a phenomenon, and it is a term that was coined in 1998 by botanist educators Elizabeth Schussler and James Wandersee. And what it describes is the inability to see and notice the plants in your own environment. People will easily recognize animals, have challenges recognizing plants. And since plants are absolutely essential to life, right? Not just the food we eat, but the clean air we breathe, the water around us, the environmental conditions in which we live, plant blindness really can have disastrous consequences for us as a human race and as a planet.
I wonder, is it just because we don't have as many plants in urban areas, or we don't see wide open spaces with grassland and wild plants growing?
I think it's part. I don't think it's so much. It, in some cases, it is about access to green space, and that is why communities like, I mean, I'm here in Madison, but other communities all over the country, why there is such a strong movement for community greening. And community greening may take the place of reclaiming, you know, underbuilt areas and reclaiming them for green space and bringing it into close proximity. Here where we are on the UW campus, we've got rooftop gardens and places that can be accessible. Even if you're in an indoor setting, you can just get up and out without having to go out into the forest. The school garden brings that plant life and that connection to plants right up close and personal for kids in the places that they are every single day. So it's really where they're living, where they're playing. And for students, school is where they're working, right?
What are some characteristics that a teacher should have as they incorporate gardening into their curriculum? I mean, what if they're not a gardener themselves?
Well, very often they're not gardeners, and that is something that we've learned. The American Horticultural Society has been running the Children and Youth Garden Symposium for 27 years. So we were very early in the youth gardening movement, and we've really focused on this kind of train the teacher approach to it. And early on, it was people who just, what we see is it's either someone who has always loved gardening and then finds this as their path in school, or often it's someone who teaches something else who the school may say, can you do this? And then they're really scrambling to find garden resources, to find garden mentors. So that you bring a healthy, a good school garden teacher needs. They need a healthy dose of curiosity. They need to be really willing to experiment, as all science is experimental in nature, and you have to learn what works and what doesn't work. A real penchant for hands-on learning, and if you want to see your kids absolutely blossom, get them out in the dirt. And a sense of the importance and power of diversity. Because biodiversity and growing a range of things and having a diverse set of options for children and the way they learn, that's how we really address the whole child in the classroom. And so I think all of that is much more important than deep horticultural knowledge, because horticultural knowledge and information about how to start seeds and grow plants, it's readily available. It's readily available from the AHS website at ahsgardening.org. It's readily available from kidsgardening.org. It's readily available from a number of places.
It seems like the society is really taking this very seriously, mm-hmm. this youth generation, because you see the future there. It is the next generation of who you will be mm-hmm. as a society. Mm-hmm. How important is it to kind of pass that torch in gardening?
Well, it's very important. You know, we find that there is a cohort of gardeners who are, you know, in their 50s and older, who have had one kind of life experience. The way people live and where they live is changing. So that is changing people's way of gardening. Right now, what we see in many, many young adults is a real resurgence of interest in plants, in plant-based lifestyle. So plant-based food choices, plant-based product choices. People are highly interested in succulents and houseplants, and partly because they're more portable.
Huh.
And people are moving frequently. Somebody may not have access to a backyard garden. Also growth in the community gardening movement. People are wanting a plot. And the reason they want a community garden may be to grow food for themselves, but it's likely also largely because they want to build relationships with people in their communities.
Speaking of those relationships, parents who want to get a plot going with their kids at home, and, you know, there's that time crunch. There's only so many hours in a day. How do you make time for gardening at home?
Well, I grew up gardening with my kids, and it doesn't mean that they grew up loving gardening, although I am happy to say that my daughter is now working in the land conservation movement, so I think she kind of got close. And my son has some herbs on his porch, so I did my job. You know, how do you make time for it? I think that whether you're doing it right on your windowsill with three little pots of herbs and you're just saying, here, smell and taste this, and then watch what it does to your eggs. You know, do you like your eggs better or worse with it? You know, that's gardening in and of itself. We have to have a broader definition of gardening that doesn't necessarily just match I'm outside, I have a large plot, and I've got tomatoes in cages, because not everybody can do that. Container gardening is a huge opportunity, even if somebody's living in a small apartment, as long as they have some access to sunlight somewhere. You can put a...
Sounds like scale is mm-hmm. something that you really take seriously, that you just don't have to scale up right away or perhaps at all.
Well, and this is definitely not a one-size-fits-all. The same thing doesn't grow everywhere across the country. The same conditions don't exist. People's needs are very different. And so I think it is the ultimate way to be, you know, very authentic, very community-based, to really address the individual needs of the locality and the children. I know you mentioned the piece that we just heard was from a Community Groundworks site, mm-hmm. and we're thrilled to have Community Groundworks as our local partners for this, as well as the Wisconsin School Garden Network and UW-Madison's Environmental Design Lab. We really can't do this conference without those kinds of local partners. So later in the conference, we're going to be touring a number of local sites. And that's one of the things we always build into this, because we move this conference around the country. So we're going to go to school gardens at the Madison Children's Museum, the Troy Kids Garden, the UW-Madison Botany Facility. So we're going to see a different viewpoint of how people are gardening in this city.
For teachers who are out there thinking about their school year next year and, you know, wanting to start a garden and maybe trying to figure out what is my first step, what are those initial first steps?
The first step is to work a bit on getting some administration buy-in if the administration isn't part of that process immediately. Because having access to land and finding a way to either incorporate it into the day or incorporate it into an after school or out of school portion of the program is important. I also, the educators that I talk with say, don't think of it as an extra activity. Think of it as a way to teach the standards that you're already teaching. And then you're doing two things at once, which is always good if you're a teacher because you have to be able to multitask. But you're also providing a different kind of setting for learning. And with all kinds of learners at the table, settings are really important for the different kinds of learners. So some who don't do well in a classroom may do very well in the outdoor setting.
Beth, thank you so much for joining us.
Welcome.
Beth Tuttle is president and CEO of the American Horticultural Society. The National Children and Youth Garden Symposium runs through Saturday in Madison. Coming up, states bordering Wisconsin are legalizing marijuana. Next year, recreational marijuana is legal in Illinois, and an attorney explains how that change could affect Wisconsin's marijuana legislation and the way Wisconsinites engage with it. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.